worker, activist, technician in the ongoing struggle towards justice and peace.
This is WBAI 99.5 New York.
Good evening and welcome to Outlooks, produced by GLIB, the Gay and Lesbian Independent Broadcasters. Tonight our theme is New York's response to AIDS. We will be taking a close look at our city's policies in the midst of a health crisis. I'm Nicholas Cimarelli, and I will be co-hosting this program along with Sherwin Thomas and Elaine Merritt. Say hello, Sherwin.
Hi, my name, I'm Sherwin Thomas.
Elaine, why don't you say hello to our audience out there?
Good evening.
We have four guests this evening who will be joining us in a roundtable discussion. Three of our guests are members of ACT UP. Jim Igo is currently working with their Treatment Issues Committee. Richard Jackman is heavily involved with ACT UP's Housing Issues Committee. And Alexis Danzik is one of several spokeswomen for ACT UP's Women's Caucus. And we are also very fortunate to have with us tonight the Executive Director of the Minority Task Force on AIDS, Ronald Johnson. And now Sherwin is going to give us a little background about our special guest, Ronald Johnson.
Thanks very much, Nick. Our special guest, Ronald Johnson, he's the director of the Minority Task Force on AIDS, which was founded in 1986, mainly to provide advocacy, education, and direct services related to AIDS and HIV. It was the first organized group to focus on the specific impact on AIDS in the minority communities. Ron, could you care to tell us in a few sentences a little bit more as to what the task force is all about?
Well, as you pointed out, we were created to provide advocacy, education, and direct support services related to AIDS and HIV infection. And at the time of its formation, we were the first organized group looking at the impact that AIDS was having on people of color. Some of our direct services that we have a dinner program that operates on Monday evenings. We have a buddy support program, and we do individual crisis intervention counseling to people with AIDS, people with ARC, and people who are HIV positive.
Okay, thank you.
Now, Alex, you're with ACT UP, and could you give an overview of your organization for our listeners?
Sure. My name's Alexis, actually. We are the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. That's ACT UP, a diverse, nonpartisan group united in anger and committed to direct action to end the AIDS crisis, as we say every Monday night at our weekly meetings at the Gay and Lesbian Community Center at 208 West 13th Street. What we do is we meet with officials, government officials, and public health officials. We research and distribute information about AIDS. Most recently, we had a series of teach-ins which are connected with our upcoming action on the 28th, this coming Tuesday. We had a city issues teach-in and a women in AIDS teach-in, which covered much of the information that I'll be talking about tonight. And we also publicized the effects of government negligence on the communities, and I emphasize communities, plural, affected by the AIDS crisis.
Well, you're certainly a busy organization, and I know that for many New Yorkers, it's a household word at this point in time. I'd like to begin tonight's discussion basically by having our guests present what you perceive to be the current policies, if in fact New York City does have a policy on AIDS. What is it, and what are the problems with it? And any one of you can jump in and take that question.
Okay, here goes.
Alexis, it's yours.
As far as I'm concerned, the city policies are marked by complete negligence in terms of women with AIDS. I'd like to give a little background on the specifics, because there are myths concerning women and AIDS. One of the myths is that women don't get AIDS. This is untrue. One of the problems is that women don't get diagnosed with AIDS, And when women are actually diagnosed, they tend to die faster than the average male PWA. I think that my comrades here and Ronald would probably bear me out when I say that women and adolescents are the future of the epidemic. Women are 12% of the New York City cases cumulatively since 1981 in the AIDS crisis as a whole, and women represent 17% of New York cases since 1988. 25% of these cases of women with AIDS are adolescents. So that's a little bit of background information. The way that women fit into the crisis is that women are disempowered. Our access to health care is limited by who we are and where we live and how much money we have. For instance, AZT, the one drug federally approved and available, costs $8,000, between $8,000 and $10,000 per year, which is more money than 50% of the women in the U.S. in the paid labor force earn. So you can imagine how many women AZT is completely unavailable for. Family conditions may make it impossible for women and adolescents to seek health care. 200,000 kids in New York City have one IV drug-using parent. That means 10% of New York City's 2 million children have one parent who is at risk for AIDS. And another way this statistic comes out is that the National Women's Health Network predicts that this is a national statistic, not a New York statistic, that there will be 72,000 orphans if 80% of the women infected with HIV die. A couple of problems that coincide with women and AIDS is that, and Rich will be speaking about this, is that New York City has a 3-year wait for public housing. There are no new treatment centers for drug users that have been open since 1972. These are just sort of a laundry list of issues that help put women at risk in New York City.
Ronald, could you give us a little information regarding minority women and AIDS?
Well, in terms of minority women, it's pretty much a similar situation that as has just been described. Minority women are very much at risk of AIDS, and in many ways the impact of AIDS among women of color is the fastest growing area of AIDS and is likely, as has just been stated, the future of AIDS. Women who are, particularly women of color who are IV drug users, represent nearly 60% of the female adult cases with AIDS, and nearly a quarter are also the sexual partners of male IV drug users. And there are not enough programs to deal with these issues. The very limited drug treatment programs that there are very heavily male-oriented and are not oriented to the female IV drug user, and particularly not oriented to women of color. So there's a sex bias there, and there is also a very real cultural bias against women, and this is having a devastating impact on women of color who are very vulnerable to HIV infection.
Alexis, I think you want to make a comment on that?
I'd just like to follow this up with some specific New York information. As of February 7th, 2,301 women in New York City were diagnosed with CDC, that's the Centers for Disease Control, defined AIDS. 53% of those were African Americans, 32% of those were Latino women, 15% of those are white, Asian, Native American women. We don't know precisely what kind of specific opportunistic infections most affect women because the city does not break down those reports by gender. The problems in general of women in diagnosis are enormous. In New York City, in the unknown, undetermined other category for transmission risks, men represent 3%, but it's 10% for women. Surveillance is not adequate or accurate in terms of HIV transmission routes and women. For instance, ARC is completely undocumented in New York City in terms of women. 46% of people, all people in New York City hospitalized for HIV are in fact chronic ARC patients. That's AIDS-related complex. In other words, these people do not meet the CDC-defined understanding of full-blown AIDS. And women most frequently are, in fact, ARC patients and die with ARC, not AIDS. They are not recognized by New York City or the CDC as people with AIDS. So actually, our statistics on women with AIDS are very faulty and don't represent what is really happening.
This is a shocking statement that you're making, because I would think then that things are really well understated from what you're saying.
Completely.
Yeah, Ronald, would you like to expand on that?
Absolutely. And we also, in the sense that given the situation of many women, again, women of color, and particularly low-income women who are the primary caregivers in their family, and so much of their attention is given to taking care of their family, so their own personal health care often is neglected. So when many of the women who are at risk of getting infected become infected and seek medical care, by that time their health has been so compromised that they're in a very serious situation. And given the unavailability in many cases of health care and limited health care in low-income areas, this again represents a very serious crisis for women.
Yeah.
Jim?
Hi, I'm Jim, and as it was said, I work mostly with the Treatment and Data Committee of ACT UP. And before I say a few words about the collapse of the healthcare system in New York, because lots of the work that we do is looking at the research and regulatory establishments on a national level to look at what is keeping effective therapies from people with AIDS and AIDS-related conditions, I'd like to say a few things about the politics nationally that I think are keeping those therapies away from the people who need it. First, there's what I call the practical politics of the influential constituencies. In this country, the populations that AIDS has hit hardest, gay men and intravenous drug users, have historically been despised and marginalized. So there was never much political pressure to fund basic research into AIDS. And now that mainstream America believes there's already been some significant funding, there's a detectable ripple of resentment that this disease of so-called culpable minorities is taking so much of the research dollar. Another type of politics is just the research, the academic politics of basic research. Research scientists like to work on things that they think advances big science. And it's a mindset that privileges the elegance of a solution to a knotty scientific problem over the development of therapies that improve the day-to-day lives of people with AIDS and AIDS-related conditions, so that finding a magic bullet cure is likelier to win a prize and advance a career than finding effective therapy for a fungal infection. And yet people with AIDS today need both types of research. Then there's the economic politics, or the market politics of the drug companies. The big high-tech companies favor high-tech solutions, knowing that's where the big money is, in testing kits, in a knockout cure, and maybe eventually a vaccine for the millions. But there's little chance that high-powered pharmaceutical companies will fund research into whether a cheap but unpatentable substance can help the immune system, because where's the payoff? Like academic politics, this economic politics favors final solutions over everyday ones, and in that process, writes off just about everybody who has AIDS now. And then the final politics is the bureaucratic politics of the regulators. Before a drug is approved, it goes through a clinical trials process, which tests a drug by giving it to some people with a disease, but not giving it to others. And although the controlled clinical trial is a historical entity of relatively recent vintage, the only data the regulators will now accept is from such trials, so that, for example, a drug, DHPG, which is proven safe and more than 80% effective in treating the retinitis of more than 5,000 immune-suppressed people, has been denied marketing approval recently to the universal outcry of people with AIDS, AIDS activists, and frontline doctors and ophthalmologists. And it was denied approval because its irrefutable data were not gathered in a controlled trial. Now, these remarks talk about politics and a social context somewhat wider than we had thus far, but I think it makes it see how difficult the issue is nationally right now. In New York, particularly, we're talking about a healthcare system that is on the verge of collapse. The hospitals in New York City, the municipal hospitals run by the Health and Hospitals Corporation, have been said by many people within the system to be on the verge of collapse. And we have conditions right now where more than half the people who are diagnosed with AIDS in this city are diagnosed through emergency rooms. That has overburdened the emergency rooms, which are about to collapse. And that makes for a particular difficulty here in New York City. When most of the people in New York City are receiving their primary care, their primary diagnosis, through the emergency rooms of the hospital.
Absolutely. What could you say regarding City Hall's response to all of this?
Well, I understand the mayor was at Rikers Island the other day, and he talked indirectly about the ACT UP demonstration that's taking place on Tuesday and accused us of going down to picket him because it only costs $1 to get a token to go down to see him rather than going to Albany or Washington. I will say personally that the week before last, on Tuesday I was in Albany and on Wednesday I was in Washington, D.C. We happen to work on state, local, and federal level because that's the only way you can get anything done in this country. But the mayor's response has been pretty poor. In his book, he talks about giving out cookies in a hospital to people with AIDS, and after he gave out the cookies to the people with AIDS, he had to go wash his hands. And it was said on the floor of ACT UP a few weeks ago by one of our members, Bob Rasky, that that's pretty typical of the mayor's response to AIDS. All he's done is hand out cookies and wash his hands, and I think that about says it.
Jim, the Partnership for the Homeless estimates that at least 5,000 homeless persons in New York City has AIDS. Do you think their estimate is too large or too small? Anyone?
Well, my name's Rich.
But, okay, Rich.
Actually, they estimated a range of 5,000 to 8,000.
Uh-huh.
And the Housing Caucus was looking at that number. First, I have to say that it's very difficult to do a calculation of homeless people because of the population. It's a very itinerant population. It's very hard to do any sort of studies. But their study was very complete and very definitive. And I would say not only is it the best study done thus far as I know, it's the only one. The city has not even made an attempt.
Right.
Our tentative opinion of it is that it's a conservative number, that is, that it's too low.
I see.
In fact, they as much said so because when you go down their calculations of each category of types of homeless people, overall the rate of HIV illness is about 10% until you get to the category for people in welfare hotels, which they had no access to and no information on, so they made a conservative estimate of 3%. That seems a little unlikely. You would think it would actually run in the range of the rest.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there are a lot of people that would go uncounted in a calculation such as this. But the city, of course, has made absolutely no attempt to determine how many homeless people with AIDS and HIV illness there are, and in fact told us that it was impossible to do this. When in a meeting that we had with Karen Schwab, who's a special advisor to the mayor and on health care and the person who's supposed to be in charge of housing for people with AIDS in New York City, so you have an idea of how well she's done her job.
Yeah.
When we asked her about this, she said that we asked her how many people the city thought were homeless who had HIV illness. She said that she had no idea.
Jesus.
And that there was no way of knowing unless you did mandatory testing, which, of course, everyone is opposed to.
Of course.
She was kind of, you know, bringing out the bogeyman of mandatory testing to scare us off.
Right.
But it's very contradictory because they have a proposal of a sort for housing people with AIDS based on numbers in the five-year plan.
Uh-huh.
which, you know, numbers which are totally ludicrous, because all they did was count people that were already in the system, people that were in the hospitals or people that they had already housed.
Yeah.
Or people that, a scattering of people that had managed to get paperwork into the Human Resources Administration,
okay,
which they euphemistically referred to as currently residing in the community awaiting placement. So that, you know, they're basing their proposals on totally bogus numbers and then turning around and saying they don't have any numbers,
okay,
and that they can't do the numbers, so what do you expect?
Yeah, okay, fine.
Ronald, what is the task force position on City Hall's response to AIDS? I'm sure that you have a lot to say about that.
Well, I think the city's response, the city as a whole, has been clearly inadequate to deal with the AIDS crisis. It's certainly inadequate given the fact that New York City has one quarter of the total AIDS cases in the United States, and it's inadequate given the fact, as I said, this is a clear health emergency. When one looks at the various dimensions, whether it's homelessness, healthcare, access to healthcare, access to treatment, the impact that AIDS is having on women, people of color, the increasing impact on adolescents, you see no city policies that are adequate to that response. So if one were to judge and evaluate the city's response, one would have to say that it is clearly inadequate given the fact that New York City has the leading number of cases of AIDS in New York City and that this is a clear health emergency for many, many people in our city.
Ronald, is there in fact a policy for adolescents on AIDS in New York City?
Not that we can detect. If there is one, then we have yet to see it. The Board of Education's response, many people feel, and the Hedrick Martin Institute has done a lot on this, many people feel that the educational response has been less than forthcoming, and we don't see what anything being geared up for adolescents and teenagers.
Alexis, you want to jump in?
Yeah, sure. There's a real problem here. I mean, the city's campaign in terms of education, which many people, if they ride the subways, have probably seen, are those very graphic black, white, and red advertisements that say, think how much you want it before you do it. And they're in English and also Spanish. We really think that that's a disinformation campaign. It's promoting not only abstinence, which is not really the right way to go about preventing anything from teen pregnancy to AIDS, but it's also promoting fear. This was developed, I believe, at the request of the Catholic Church. In other words, none of the groups such as Hedrick Martin, no teenager advocacy groups, no public school educators were ever really involved in that project. Also, teenagers are specifically at risk because they can't get into drug trials. Drug trials do not allow people under 18 to enter them. And for many people in the AIDS crisis, drug trials, experimental drug trials, are the only form of treatment that is available.
Yeah, just a little bit about the adolescent, the crisis, really, with AIDS among adolescents in this city is largely an unknown one. A few weeks ago, I heard Dr. Iris Davis of the Woodhull Clinic out in Brooklyn speaking, and she said the thing that has frightened her in the last several months most is the high rate of infection she's finding among adolescents through what she calls lateral transmission, and by that she means transmission out of anyone you would think of as being in anything remotely like what we have called up till now the high-risk groups. And she compared it to 1981 in Harlem when she was working up there, and she started to see an incredibly high rate of TB among the sex partners of drug users. And they tried to convince the CDC that this meant something, but of course the CDC didn't listen. It's only a few weeks ago, finally, we get well-heeled studies saying that TB is probably a marker for HIV infection. Well, if Dr. Davis is right, and we are seeing incredibly high numbers of infection among our adolescents in places like Brooklyn, we really should be doing more about the adolescent problem, and that certainly is not telling kids that you will die if you have sex. That's insufficient. It will, in fact, force people into high-risk categories. We will, in fact, be socializing people into high-risk categories by withholding the information from them that would help them save their lives.
And here we are eight years later without much having been accomplished. We're going to have to take a little music break now, but before I do, I just want you to know that you're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM New York.
Abrasive and loud, he can roar like a lion or be meek as a lamb. God knows he's courageous and sometimes outrageous. He inspires me to be all that I can. But I'll never forget the last time we met, how my heart stopped at the story he told. He said, life can be hard when it deals you a card that you never expected to hold. Then he said, it's not the end. I rely on my friends for all the affection and the love they provide. And maybe with hugs and without booze and drugs, there is still a good chance that I may survive.
And maybe he will, cause he's active still. He goes to the marches and all the parades. He's not giving in, he's determined to win. He's a person who's living with AIDS.
Living with love.
Living
in fear, embracing the light when shadows appear. It's a place to begin. It's a good way to start. Releasing the power we hold in our hearts. Of our lovers, our sisters and brothers, is a wound that cuts deep through our history of pride.
And one way to heal,
one way to
all the pain that
the pain we feel,
is to stand by the living and remain unified. So if you've got a friend whose condition is grim, don't go burying him or drawing the shades. Surrender your doubt by reaching out to a person who's living with AIDS.
Living with love,
living with love,
living in fear,
healing with hope
and drawing them,
and drawing them.
It's a place to begin.
It's a step we can take,
empowering people whose lives are at stake. Living with love,
living with love,
not fear. Embracing the light when shadows appear. It's a place to begin. It's a good way to start.
It's time for New York residents to learn all they can about AIDS and how they can protect themselves against this international health crisis. Philosopher Bertrand Russell once said, "To conquer fear is the beginning of wisdom." Get the facts about AIDS. Contact the AIDS hotline at 718-485-8111. This has been a public service of WBAI on behalf of the New York City Department of Health. Again, the AIDS hotline number is 485-8111.
Welcome back to Outlooks. You just heard Living with AIDS by Romanofsky and Phillips. And now Elaine Merritt will be interviewing our guest.
Alexis, you brought up some points about the demographics of women and AIDS. Could you talk about the lesbian risk of AIDS?
Sure. This is another myth that lesbians do not get AIDS. It's a myth, unfortunately, that our government has been clearly responsible for fostering. In 1984, the CDC stopped taking information on specifically on lesbians and bisexual women who had AIDS, and they lumped lesbians and bisexual women under the category women and AIDS, thereby not only denying the potential risk factors, but making it impossible for lesbians to find out clear, useful information about our risk factors, our risk ability. What has happened because of this is that the community, most women just don't know how to go about thinking about lesbian risk. We have been taught, on the one hand, to see ourselves as sort of like the chosen people, and on the other hand, when we try to go to give blood, we are told that because we're homosexuals, we can't do that. So it's a very strange and frightening situation for lesbians to be in. An early study by Dr. Peter Drottman of the CDC went over the fact that there, in fact, were 101 cases of lesbian and bisexual women who, in fact, have AIDS. Most of these, the risk factor was IV drug use. But for approximately, I think, two cases, definitively, the risk factor was, in fact, sexual transmission. So it is possible. Now, the reason why women can't get this information is clearly because the people who are calculating our risks are not interested in our lives. There was actually a caller just reminded me of this case. There was a case of a diabetic man who had become HIV positive through oral sex, a continued relationship with a prostitute where they only did oral sex. She may have had her period during this time. In any case, it's very interesting for us in the activist lesbian AIDS community to know that it's this one case of heterosexual transmission where a man has become HIV positive that has all of a sudden alarmed the statisticians. We think that this is really outrageous. Nothing has been done to inform lesbians of not only their risk, but also how to think about their risk history and how to better prepare ourselves for the fact that lesbians are PWAs. Now, there are lesbian health workers who have invented some incredibly wonderful and useful safer sex techniques, and these include things like dental dams, which are usually used by dentists to isolate an infected tooth. These are squares of latex, which women can use for oral sex with an infected partner. They work very similarly to a condom. You can use them with a non-oxynol 9 lubricant, so they feel really nice. But this kind of information is not widely available to women. Women are not encouraged to seek out this information. And if you phone the AIDS hotline, you will not know that lesbians are, in fact, at risk. And this is deadly information.
I have another question for the Women's Committee of ACT UP. Do you see your role more as a support group for gay men with AIDS or as AIDS activist within the women's community?
Am I allowed to say hell no on the radio?
You sure can.
No, we are doing this in solidarity with the gay men's community, and we are doing this because lesbians are at risk. I would like to say that the Women's Caucus of ACT UP is not just made up of lesbians. There are straight women and bisexual women in the caucus, and we would certainly like to have new members join us. But our role is really motivated by general concern. Most of the women in the committee are, in fact, feminists. I know that's an unpopular word these days. And we're motivated by our concern for women in general, and perhaps some of us for lesbians in particular.
Ronald, how widespread is the infection with the AIDS virus in the Black and Latino communities? How widespread would you say?
We don't have any clear, reliable data that would tell us the exact zero prevalence in the Black and Hispanic communities, but there are enough indications that HIV infection is widespread, and certainly the risk of HIV infection is very clear and widespread throughout the Black and Latino communities. The fact that most of the IV drug users in New York City are Black and Hispanic puts them particularly at risk, particularly if they are engaging in behaviors such as needle sharing or unprotected sex, that increases the risk of HIV infection. Among Black and Hispanic men who have sex with men, there are indications that many of Black and Hispanic men who have sex with men are not engaging in safer sex to the degree to which many white gay men are, and the educational message has not trickled down sufficiently to Black and Hispanic men who have sex with men. Many of the fact that the city has only now just sought wisdom to have a campaign that is directed to the gay male community after 7 or 8 years into the crisis. But again, the fact is that many Black and Hispanic men who have sex with men are not getting that kind of educational message, and the kind of sexual practices that give a high risk for HIV infection are still being practiced among Black and Hispanic men, and that puts them at risk. So the exact data that we have, it's not available, but there are enough indications to say that the HIV infection, or at least the risk of HIV infection, is still very serious in the Black and Hispanic communities.
Yeah. Would you also say that there is widespread denial about AIDS in the Black and Latino communities, and if so, why?
That's probably one of the biggest problems that we face in working in the Black and Hispanic communities, is this sense of denial. A lot of it is the denial of based upon the perception that AIDS is a white man's disease, the connection with white gay men, for example. Many Black and Hispanic people erroneously feel that, you know, it's not going to affect me. So there's a great deal of denial of personal risk.
Yeah.
There is also the connection that AIDS has with two subjects that are very taboo and very sensitive among Black and Hispanic peoples, i.e. sex and drugs. Particularly in the middle class communities, it's very difficult to talk about sex in general, homosexuality in particular.
Yeah.
I've heard people say there are people within the Hispanic community say that there are no Hispanic gay people, you know, and that is clearly ridiculous.
Yes.
In Black communities, there's often an acceptance that there are Black homosexuals, but there's a feeling that there shouldn't be Black homosexuals. So you get that also added on as a sense of denial and not wanting to deal with the subject and not wanting to deal with junkies and drug addicts and pretending that the subject is going to go away if we don't talk about it. But it's here and it's real, and that denial can be very, very deadly.
Yeah. What do you think can be done to help persons who are healthy but infected with the AIDS virus?
Healthy and infected?
Yeah. What do you think the city could do to help these people? People who are, persons who are healthy but infected but are HIV positive, let's say.
Well, assuming that they know that they are HIV positive, mm-hmm. There is a great deal that could be done in terms of just counseling to help deal with the fact of HIV infection. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of people who come into our offices on being found told that they are HIV positive, sit down and say, "When am I going to die?" And this, to me, reflects a great deal of lack of information about what HIV infection is and how they can manage and live and with HIV infection and what they have to do, the kind of counseling and what treatments are available, and just ongoing education and making access to medical care more available.
Okay. Jamie, want to add something?
Yes, right. Both Ronald and Alexis have just talked about the prevalence among groups of people of color and women. Uh-huh. I'd like to say a little bit about why in this city in particular and in the country in general, uh-huh. treatments are less available to people of color and women than they are to other groups. In New York City in particular, because the poor people of the city are disproportionately women and people of color, the fact that the municipal hospital system is collapsing disproportionately affects those people. Those people mostly do not have private doctors, do not have private insurance, therefore are on Medicaid, and therefore are diagnosed and get their primary care through the emergency rooms of this hospital. Right now in this city, you wait on an average in some hospitals of 4 days in the emergency room before you can get a bed. Yeah. These are atrocious conditions. But there are also other things that are keeping treatments from people of color and women. AIDS is a new disease. Many of the effective drugs for the opportunistic infections that we associate with AIDS are with unapproved drugs. Mm-hmm. And the way you get unapproved drugs in this country is either you enter a drug trial or you get it through some extraordinary early release of the drug through things called a treatment protocol or a compassionate use protocol. If you don't have the doctor that will show you through the maze to get these drugs, you're not going to get them. If you don't have the counseling, you will not even know that they exist. And yet right now we know there are very effective early interventions against HIV, and we have some very effective drugs against the opportunistic infections associated with AIDS. But you can't get a drug on a treatment protocol in a municipal hospital because the costs are not covered by Medicare nationally and Medicaid locally. And so this effectively eliminates virtually all poor people from treatment IND drugs in municipal hospitals in this city. And that's a very shocking thing, because we have some early interventions such as aerosolized pentamidine, which is very effective against the recurrence of PCP pneumonia, the leading killer of people with AIDS, and yet many people in this city don't know about it, and since it's available on treatment IND, there are many people who would not be able to get the drug in this city right now.
So access is definitely one of the major problems. Alexis?
Yeah. I also want to talk specifically, relate this issue right back to women. The CDC definition of AIDS was redefined in September of 87. It was redefined in terms of specific types of illness. Dementia was one of them. This increased the diagnosis by 22%. In other words, there were 22% of people were included in the definition of full-blown AIDS because of this redefinition. However, this redefinition was not good for women, necessarily. Women are still not covered by CDC definitions, and we manifest symptoms that they do not include. These are, a lot of them are gynecological infections, chronic vaginitis, pelvic inflammatory disease. In a Newark, New Jersey study, women with HIV spectrum illness, more than half of them had gynecological symptoms, 25% with chronic vaginitis, and 7% with pelvic inflammatory disease so severe it would have required hospitalization in and of itself. Other situations that we think are interesting to be crucial to be looked at for women in AIDS are the rises in influenza and pneumonia deaths among women. The fact that STDs like gonorrhea, syphilis, and chlamydia can be cofactors and can hasten HIV spectrum illnesses. These can be asymptomatic in women, syphilis, gonorrhea, and chlamydia. And this has a long history, which is very poignant for women because many of the tests for STDs work for men, i.e. they can detect these diseases in men, but they don't really work for women, so that women actually have to be in more advanced stages with these diseases before people know what's going on. These are just some of the problems faced by women. In New York City, women's life expectancy, once they are diagnosed with AIDS, is shorter. In fact, it's 9.9 months for women and 12.5 months for men.
So really what you're saying is that there are a number of related illnesses that are not being categorized for women that should be considered at risk for AIDS, and they're not being screened out. And that is really why we're having women diagnosed years beyond.